Meeting of the House Judiciary Committee will come back to order. It is now 2:07. It's Friday, April 1st, in the state capitol, room 120, the Grunberg Room. We've got members present, Representative Lynn, Representative Klayman, Representative Chris Tompkins, my co-chair, Representative Keller.
We got a promotion. The vice chair.
I'm sorry,
and myself, Chair Ledoux. We do have a quorum. Everyone, please silence their cell phones. Thank you, Christy, for being our recording secretary, and Ben from the Juno LIO for teleconferencing support. Today, we're taking back up House Bill 236 to hear public testimony. Do we have anybody online who wants to testify? Looks like we might have two people online. To begin with, Joshua Decker. Joshua, are you there?
I am, Madam Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Do you want to identify yourself for the record, and then you may proceed?
Yes. My name is Joshua Decker. I am the Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska. We emailed members of the committee written testimony on HB 236 just a short while ago. I apologize for getting it to you so close in time to the committee. Our testimony is HB 236 both does something good as well as we think inadvertently dramatically changes the balance between religious freedom and secular non-discrimination law that we've had in this country for 62 years. On the front end, the ACLU strongly supports the First Amendment right of clergy to choose to solemnize or not solemnize marriages that comport with their faith. That is the first freedom of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and it is a right that the ACLU would robustly go to court to vindicate, the right of clergy to say that they do not have to solemnize marriages that do not align with their religious views. We've cited in our written testimony to the committee examples of the ACLU going to court to vindicate one's right to practice one's religion. Last year alone, we've listed six cases that we've gone to court to protect. We average about one lawsuit per month where we are standing up for Americans' rights to practice their religion as their faith dictates. And so while we certainly agree with that constitutional maxim, the concerns we have with HB 236 is it disturbs a long-standing balance point between the right of individuals to pray and practice their faith with the right of the public to be treated fairly and free from discrimination in public spaces. For the past 62 years, since the original Civil Rights Act of last century, we as a society have struck a balance between private spaces and public spaces. And when organizations open themselves up to the public, they have to treat all comers fairly. And the concern that we have with HB 236 is it undoes this carefully constructed balance. No less of a defender of the freedom of religion than Justice Antonin Scalia 26 years ago wrote about this balance and that we want to ensure that laws of general applicability that apply to everyone equally should in fact apply to everyone equally and that we should not move this equilibrium point religious organizations. What we offer in our testimony as two appendices on pages 4 and 5 are suggestions that would make the bill pass muster to clarify the right of clergy and the right of religious organizations to practice their faith when they are not open to the public, but to make it clear that if they are open to the public, then they should treat all comers equally. If there are any questions from the committee, I'm more than happy to answer them.
Do we have any questions from the committee?
Question.
Yes, Representative Mann.
Would you please help me understand what you mean by open to the public, like a church open to the public? Well, obviously, you know, many of us have membership in a church someplace, so it's open to us. But I can't think of any churches that are not, that wouldn't welcome somebody to visit the church for whatever reason, to visit, that is. So that would be open to the public. We don't lock the doors to a church, right? We don't lock the doors and open up for each individual parishioner or congregation member. It's open to the public, but still there's the church and the membership and the church, et cetera.
Through the chair, thank you for that question, Representative Lynn. It's a good point that you're honing in on. By open to the public, we mean open to the public in the secular space. So certainly, yes, churches that are engaging in religious services, the fact that they are open to anyone who wants to come in and participate in the religious service, they are exempt from non-discrimination laws in that capacity. What we mean in our testimony about open to the public is, I think, elucidated in yesterday's testimony regarding the Shrine of St. Therese in Juneau, that they have event space that they are open to the public for secular purposes that they rent out. I think there was an example of members of the Lutheran community renting out part of that banquet hall space for a secular wedding reception. That is what we mean by open to the public, open to all comers in the secular, non-religious sphere.
Well, would you expect under the open to the public scenario that, for example, let's say a synagogue was going to had a place in it that they rented out to members of the public for all sorts of functions. Are you suggesting that if the Ku Klux Klan or the American Nazi Party wanted to have a celebration of Nazism, for example, in the in the space of the Jewish community, that are you saying that our laws currently make them do that?
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. No, if a synagogue or if any institution is opening up space to the public, they are allowed to turn away members of the Ku Klux Klan or the American Nazi Party, because we as a society have not said that membership in the Ku Klux Klan or membership in the American Nazi Party falls under what the law calls a protected class. There are certain categories, race, religion, sex, disability, that the law has carved out because we as a society have said that when one is open to the public, one should not treat people on the basis of race, on the basis of sex, on the basis of national origin, or physical disability differently. But we as a society have not said that about Nazism or the Ku Klux Klan, and so any event space, whether it is part of a Jewish synagogue or not, would be within their rights to say that they do not want to rent that space to a member of the American Nazi Party, the Ku Klux Klan.
Okay, so
The concern that, we...
Are all religions, I mean, is religion a protected category?
Religion is a protected category, correct. One is not
so,
allowed...
So in other words, the Catholic Church would have to rent out space, you're saying, under current law to a group that said that they were witches, for example?
It would depend on how that church treats the space. If the Catholic Church makes the decision on the front end that it is only going to rent that space out to Catholics, that is perfectly fine. The Catholic Church is allowed to treat its spaces as private. But if the Catholic Church, however, says on Tuesday we are going to rent this space out to the Girl Scouts, on Friday we are going to rent the space out to the senior citizens, then the church has made the decision to treat that particular space as part of the public. And so the church would then have to be open to the public. The churches have the ability, however, to say, we do not want to be open to the public, and in which case the law gives them complete freedom to restrict the uses of that space in accordance with the faith. But what we have had for the past 62 years is when religious entities have decided on the front end to open space up to the public, to be open to all comers, then they in fact must be open to all comers.
Including witches?
If in the hypothetical, Chair Ledoux, the church has decided to open the space to the public, then yes, it would have to be open to the public, and it could not discriminate on the basis of the religions in the same way it cannot discriminate on the basis of race, national origin, in the same way that employers cannot tell an employee, you are fired based on your religion. Those same protected classes apply to spaces of public accommodation. If churches desire to control who is able to use their spaces, they should make the eminently reasonable choice to keep those spaces public and not, in fact, open to all comers.
So let me just ask you one more question, and then Representative Keller has a question, and then Representative Millett has a question. Are you saying if we choose to pass this bill in its current form, are you saying that it is unconstitutional, or are you saying that you disagree with the policy?
Chair Ledoux, there are no constitutional cases on point, but if this bill is passed in the current form, it would dramatically rewrite the balance that we as both a country and a state have struck for 62 years.
In your opinion?
In the opinion of the U.S. and Alaska Supreme Courts, Chair Ledoux. We cite in our letter both Justice Scalia from the U.S. Supreme Court case of Employment Division, Department of Human Resources of Oregon versus Smith. That's a 1990 Supreme Court case. We also cite in our letter a 1994 case from the Alaska Supreme Court, both clearly enunciating this principle of the equilibrium point between public's freedom to be free from discrimination in public spaces and religion's freedom to exercise their religion and define it in private spaces.
Thank you. I'll note that Representative Foster has joined us. So, Representative Keller, you've got a question.
Yeah, I actually, too, under the Alaska Human Rights Act, if a church makes a property available for lease or whatever, it potentially isn't there's a problem there because somebody could allege that the church discriminated just simply for denying access to the facility, and this bill would go a ways toward clarifying that. And Madam Chair, after he responds, I would like to have another question.
Go right ahead.
Through the chair, my apologies, Vice Chair Keller. I'm not sure I understood your question, sir.
Well, under the what you're saying, under the Human Rights Act that just happened in here in Alaska, if a piece of property is not leased, you become vulnerable just because of the denial for access. And under this new Human Rights Act, am I not right? That's what the law tries to clarify, that
through the chair, Vice Chair Keller, as we read the current bill, it is trying to carve out from existing non-discrimination law places of public accommodation that religious organizations, that churches own and are renting out to the public for wedding receptions and celebrations of marriages. I apologize if I'm not entirely following your question, sir. In terms of the concern that's animating it, this bill in many ways is a solution in search of a problem. Non-discrimination protections are not new in Alaska. They are not new in the United States. In Anchorage, for example, in terms of protections for individuals who are gay and transgender, Anchorage has had these protections for the past 6 months, and neither for the past 6 months nor for the past 62 years, the sky has not fallen. We are unaware of any churches that have been unable to practice their religion as their faith teaches it on the basis of civil rights non-discrimination laws. And so because this is a solution in search of a problem and a bill that dramatically rewrites a balance that we've had for over half a century, it's for these reasons that we have made the suggestions in our letter to both reiterate the constitutional right of churches to practice their faith as they see fit, as well as to clarify that this bill should not undertake such a dramatic sea change.
Well, let's abandon that question for now. But I want to. The other question I want to ask you: you're talking a lot about this balance that's existed for 50 years, and in the review you talk about it. Are there court cases that you're using to form this review and opinion? And if there are, give me a list, please.
Through the chair, there are, Representative Keller. In our letter, we cite a U.S. Supreme Court case that was authored by Justice Scalia in a 8-1 decision. That case is in footnote 2 of our letter. It's Employment Division, Department of Human Resources of Oregon versus Smith, and the citation is 494 U.S. 872 from 1990. We also cite in our letter a case from the Alaska Supreme Court from 1994. That case is Swanner versus Anchorage Equal Rights Commission, and the citation there is 874 Pacific 2nd, 274, and it's an Alaska Supreme Court case from 1994.
Yeah, I just, one little...
Through the chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you could, just one comment. You said that it was, the balance was to protect the rights of people that were in that public place. Please just give me an illustration or two. I mean, I'm just trying to get my head around that, because that's a balance that I had never... considered here, you know, and it seems way out there, but I just want to be able to think about what you're trying to say. What is the balance between what and what?
Through the chair, the balance is that as a first principle, we as a society have decided, stretching back to 1964, that when you go to places that are open to the public, if Vice Chair Keller, you and I decide to go out to a restaurant together, it would be against the law for the owner of that restaurant to say that they are not going to serve us because we are men, because we are white, because we were born in the United States. We as a society have said for 62 years that when you go to a place that is open to all comers, they cannot turn people away because of their race, because of their sex, because of their physical disability, because of their national origin, because of their religion. And what both the United States Supreme Court as well as the Alaska Supreme Court has said is that when we have these laws of general applicability, that apply to everyone equally, that the balance we should strike is when a place is open to the public, it should be open to the public. And when religious institutions and religious organizations want to exercise their fundamentally important right to practice their faith as they see fit, and that is a right through the chair, Vice Chair Keller, that the ACLU goes to court every single month to defend, and we would roundly go to court today if one's freedom of religion was infringed upon. And so the balance that we as a society have struck is that religious organizations, when they want to fully practice their faith and be able to shield out a space that is not open to all comers, they should keep that space private. But when they make the decision on the front end to open up a banquet hall that is available to all comers, that's open to the Girl Scouts on Thursday, the senior citizens on Friday, then on Saturday, that place should also be open to all comers. That is the balance that Alaska and the United States has struck, and it's a balance that's worked well for both the public as well as for churches for 62 years.
Thank you. And that was kind of the essence of my first question, is that what's the question here is what is a public place? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Mellett.
Nope, I just think it's nonsense. No thanks.
Yeah. Representative Tyman, you look like you're about ready to ask a question.
So predictable. Joshua, I asked a question of the bishop who was talking about how they're managing the shrine of St. Teresa here in Juneau. I asked whether they would rent the shrine to a Lutheran couple who got married at the Lutheran church downtown for their wedding reception later in the day, recognizing that the Catholic priest or bishop had not performed the ceremony, and they explained that unless the Lutheran couple converted just before their wedding, they they couldn't get the priest to marry them. And so my query is, in the context of the public accommodations questions you're raising in your letter and in the proposed amendments that you submitted, what happens to the Catholic, what's your perspective about the Catholic Church if they're renting to the Lutheran couple for a reception after they're married downtown? Does that mean that they're now becoming public in your perspective for purposes of renting to a gay couple that wants to get married somewhere else but still have the reception at the shrine?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, if the Catholic Church has taken the position that it will not marry this couple because they're Lutheran, that is certainly within their rights under the First Amendment and the ACLU of Alaska. We would be honored to represent the church if there was a law that would require them to, in fact, marry this couple. But when the church has made the decision that the banquet hall, separate from the religious ceremony, but the sector of the reception, that it is willing to rent it out to the Lutheran church, to these individuals, irrespective of the fact that they're Lutheran and not Catholic, then it looks like their decision to rent the space out to that couple, irrespective of their religion, that secular reception space is, in fact, a place of public accommodation.
And follow up. So although on the one hand you're saying this looks like a problem or a solution in search of a problem, what it sounds like is that even if we pass this statute as written, or this act, or this proposal as written, there is lurking out there the potential lawsuit for the Catholic Church if they're renting their shrine for a reception to somebody that's not part of their church.
Through the chair, if the Catholic Church has decided to rent part of the shrine for secular purposes, such as secular wedding receptions, and it is open to all comers, for example, the Lutheran couple that you mentioned, then there would be a problem if the Catholic Church then decided to not rent that space to someone else who is a member of a protected class. For example, a couple based on their race, based on their disabilities, based on their national origin, because they've made the decision to open it to the public. If the Catholic Church is concerned about that, and if they do want to maintain the ability to choose to rent or not to rent that space on the basis of protected classes such as race, religion, sex, national origin, then the wiser course of action would be for the church to decide it is not going to make that space open to the public, and it is only going to keep it private and available to individuals who happen to be Catholic.
And a follow-up, I take it from your perspective, even if we pass this statute as written without either of the amendments that you propose, the statute wouldn't protect the church. You'd still have the same public accommodations arguments if they were making it available to, not limiting it to their members. You'd have that argument regardless of what the statute says.
Through the chair, certainly under federal non-discrimination law.
And I think then the last question is...
Through the chair, Representative
Cannon. I apologize. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. How you suggested two different amendments. How do those solve the problem or solve the problem that you've raised?
Through the chair, the two possible amendments, one is an Appendix A on page 4 of our testimony. I'm sorry, Appendix 1 on page 4 of our testimony. The other is Appendix 2 on page 5 of our testimony. Solve the problem by, one, reiterating the robust constitutional freedoms of clergy and religious organizations, that they do not have to solemnize marriages that they disagree with, that if their faith teaches a certain type of marriage is outside the boundary of that faith, that there is nothing under the law that requires clergy to solemnize that marriage, because that has been a freedom that has existed under the First Amendment for over 200 years. We believe the other benefit of our proposed amendments is that it clarifies this public-private distinction, that if churches want to continue to have unfettered discretion, the wiser course of action is for them to simply designate places as private, that it is not open to all comers, because if a place is not open to all comers, then non-discrimination laws do not apply. Private places, private clubs, private organizations, and churches and religious organizations are able to exercise unfettered discretion about whom to admit and whom to serve if it is not open to all comers. The crux of the matter becomes, though, once the decision has been made to be open to the public, it must in fact be open to the public. And so our proposed amendments clarify that and have the bill both focus on the constitutional right to choose which marriages to solemnize or not solemnize, as well as clarify that it is in private spaces that they have unfettered discretion about whom to admit and whom to serve.
Thank you. Representative Millett, and then I've got a question.
So if the Catholic Church decided to make it a private club and have an application for the Shrine of St. Therese, and they're made it a private club, and someone applied, and they met all the criteria of that club, and they granted them access to their private club for a fee, would that be fine?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, the Catholic Church would not even need to go that far. The Catholic Church is a religious organization, and it could simply say, we are choosing to rent this space only to co-religionists, only to individuals who happen to be Catholic. They would not need to even go through the administrative hoops of having to be a private club or membership application. They are entirely within their First Amendment rights to say this space is only open to individuals who share our religious beliefs, full stop, and in which case they are entirely protected and outside the scope of public secular non-discrimination laws.
So could they, so this is kind of interesting, I think. So could they say, instead of not, we are only going to rent this to Christians? I mean, Lutherans, and other Christian groups are pretty similar to Catholicism. Could they say they're only going to rent this to Christians?
Through the chair, in both federal as well as state constitutional law, there is a well-established principle that courts cannot interrogate the nuances of religious belief. And so if the Catholic Church takes the position that consistent with their religious faith, they only want to rent, they only want to make the space available to other individuals who believe that Jesus is the Messiah, I think they would have a strong argument that the place is in fact private. The test in terms of public accommodation is it open to all comers? And if it is not in fact open to all comers, and if the reason the church has decided not to make it open to all comers is grounded in their religious belief, I think they would have a strong argument that the space is in fact private and not public.
Then why couldn't they say, just for example, set out that one of the tenets in the church is we are going to rent this out to all people who believe that marriage is between one man and one woman?
True, the chair, I certainly don't want to get into the nuances of
That's exactly what we're getting into, is the nuances. So,
I certainly don't want to get into the nuances of Catholic doctrine, because that's certainly not an area on which I'm expert. The test in terms of public accommodation is it open to all comers? And so, if the Shrine of St. Therese is open to all comers to rent for a secular reception space, then it needs to be open to all comers. But the church is certainly within its rights to say, no, we are not going to have this open to all comers. We are only going to open it up to the private members of our community, in which case it's...
I don't think you're answering my question, actually. I asked you why couldn't it simply say that we are going to rent this out to all people who believe that marriage is between one man and one woman. You just said that it could rent it out and say that we're only going to rent this out to people who accept Jesus as the Messiah. You just said that that was okay. So why couldn't it say that we're only going to rent this out to people who believe that marriage is between one man and one woman? I mean, that's a fundamental doctrine of the faith.
Chair Ledoux, I think the
well,
the issue
there's actually no point. We're just debating this. But one other question I've got for you. So has the Supreme Court actually said that sexual orientation is a protected class?
Chair Ledoux, no, the United States Supreme Court has
thank
not
you,
yet.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Decker? Yes, Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. I've got a couple of questions. A couple of questions that I would love to direct to the bishops from yesterday, because I think a lot of the problem that I think we are seeking to solve, or the perceived problem we are seeking to solve, orients around what that problem actually is.
And no, I'd like the bishops aren't
here anymore. Yeah, I understand that. They're on another mission. So I guess maybe one question for you, Josh, is are you aware of an instance right now in Alaska where this piece of legislation would enable an organization that wants to change its policies but thus far or right now is declining to do so because of fear of exposing itself to liability?
Through the chair, no, we are not aware of any organization that, but for the fear of liability, has been inhibited from changing its policies. As we see it, there are no problems out there that this bill, in fact, would solve.
Another question. This is a follow-up from Chair Ledoux's question. So you said the Supreme Court has not defined sexual orientation as a protected class. Is it accurate to say that the Alaska Supreme Court has... Well, I guess my question is, we're basically what we're really talking about are gay marriages here. I mean, as far as I know, unless there's a different problem we're trying to solve. And you've listed all these protected classes, gender, national origin, race, etc. How would a gay couple that is getting married fall into this sort of area of non-discrimination, given that the gay couples and sexual orientation have not been defined as a protected class?
Through the chair, first, and I just want to reiterate, no couple, whether they're same-sex or opposite-sex, has a constitutional right to have a particular religious individual marry them. So nothing in Alaska, since we've had marriage equality for 18 months, or nationwide, since we've had marriage equality since last June, obligates any religious person, any member of the clergy, to officiate any wedding, same-sex or opposite-sex. The intersection between a same-sex couple that wishes to get to celebrate their marriage in a secular wedding reception would interact with this law is in communities such as Anchorage that have decided to include sexual orientation as part of existing non-discrimination law. That couple then, if a place is open to the public, has the same right as everyone else to use a place that's open to the public.
If I may interject there, Josh, so you're saying this doesn't, there isn't a protected class federally or on the state level, but this law would trump the definition of protected classes on a municipal level in communities like Anchorage and whatever other communities in Alaska have defined sexual orientation as a protected class. So therefore, protections that exist for this protected class on a municipal level would be trumped by this law. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, that is entirely accurate. It would trump municipal protections, and it's also accurate to say that both federally as well as statewide, sexual orientation is not a protected class.
Follow up?
Go right ahead.
Josh, do you know, is sexual orientation a protected class in the city and borough of Juneau?
Through the chair, sexual orientation is not a protected class in the city and borough of Juneau.
Follow up? Is it accurate, therefore, to say that the Catholic Church here in Juneau could decline to rent out the Shrine of St. Therese to a gay couple that is having a secular, non-religious celebration because gay couples and sexual orientation is not a protected class in Juneau?
Through the chair, that is also correct. Because sexual orientation is not a protected class in the city and borough of Juneau, the Catholic Church has the legal ability to choose to rent or not rent space to individuals based on their sexual orientation.
Thank you. I thought that was illuminating.
Any further questions for Mr. Decker? All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next person we've got online is Pamela Samish.
Hello, good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. So do you want to identify yourself for the record, and then you can proceed?
Yes, ma'am. Pamela Samash from Nenana, Alaska.
You can go ahead.
Okay. I have my testimony here, but I was going to ask something I've never asked during a testimony before, but it's in response to your really good question to Rep. Tallarico, and I was wondering, could I ask you a question and give you a demonstration of how I interpret the bill?
No, you can't. Testimony isn't to ask us questions.
Okay, very good. I wasn't sure, but I was just asking anyway.
Okay. No problem.
Well, then I'll go ahead and give my testimony then.
Thank you.
All righty. Thank you for your time and hearing our testimonies today. Please vote yes on HB 236. I believe this bill should pass because we as Christians are being targeted and singled out, and we need protection. As a Christian myself, I cannot participate in certain clubs or activities contradicting to the Bible, and that's my right as an American citizen to believe and serve any God I feel is best for me. The Christian church, like me, cannot support or participate in those organizations or activities against the Bible either. It's important that we have a law that keeps us from persecution and from those who feel offended if we deny access to our buildings or services for anti-Christian events. The church's financial status is generally fragile, and that's because we are trying to help people in our community that have needs, like those with addictions or single moms, homeless people, orphans in other countries, etc. One lawsuit can shut down not only the church, but all the services they provide to those in dire need. This is America, and it makes me really sad that we need to testify to protect our own Christian rights. I'm asking, please, that you vote yes on HB 236 and protect our religious freedoms. And since I can't ask you a question, all I can respond to my interpretation of the bill is when you were asking about does people that believe in Jesus or believe in sex of man, one man and one woman only allowed to use the church, you know, like facility. And I thought that was a really good question. And I'm not his lawyer and I'm not Tallarico. So if I'm messing this up, forgive me. I feel like the answer to that question isn't like everybody that walks through the door has to take a quiz on if they believe the doctrine of the church as much as does the activity that they're participating in support or contradict the doctrine of the church. In other words, if you have 10 people in there that want to participate in some homosexual event, and the doctrine says that homosexuality is wrong, you could ask those 10 people, and maybe 8 out of 10 of them would say, we believe Jesus is the Son of God. But, you know, the Bible says, and I'm not calling homosexuals demons, okay? I'm not saying that, but the Bible says even demons believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Believing Jesus Christ is the Son of God is wonderful, but the thing is, does the activity support or go against the Christian church's doctrine? That's, to me, the real point. You know, so I just want to clarify that that's my interpretation of what it means. And it would be sad to see a church, you know, that has strong religious beliefs in certain areas, not just homosexuality, but any area. You know, like you said, Ku Klux Klan, somebody mentioned. You know, nobody believes in hurting somebody just because of the color of their skin. That's ridiculous, you know. And for sure, we wouldn't, and I know my church wouldn't want to Ku Klux Klan to do a ceremony because they're hurting people. It wouldn't matter if they're protected colony or whatever by law or not, because they go against our doctrine of love for each other, and killing people is not love. So that's what I wanted to share with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pamela. Does anybody have any questions for Pamela? All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Doesn't seem to be anybody else on line right now. Is there anybody else online or either in this audience who would like to? You have a question for?
I wonder, could I ask another question of Mr. Decker, if he's still online, based on the previous testimony?
I'm still here, yes.
Go right ahead.
So this is prompted by the previous testimony, and I'm really just sort of going on, I guess, jurisprudential or philosophical adventure. If the NAACP had a hall or a building and decided to open up that building in a non-private manner, so beyond the functions of NAACP chapter and their meetings, and rent it to all comers, as you pointed out per the test. I know this is probably an uncomfortable question to ask, but could our sort of favorite demon for all these examples, the Ku Klux Klan, ask to rent that out as a comer of all comers who might come to rent this facility? And would they have any grounds to do so and appeal for non-discrimination in asking to rent that facility?
Through the chair, no. The Ku Klux Klan is not a protected class. And so if the NAACP does have a space that is opening up to all comers, they are still able to turn people away as long as that decision is not based on a protected class. And so since the Ku Klux Klan is not a protected class, the NAACP would be well within its legal rights to say, no, we are not going to rent this space to the Ku Klux Klan.
So let me just follow up on this for a second. If there were religion out there, and I don't know whether there is, but if there were, that had one of its tenets, there's a word for it. No.
Aztec?
No. Where you can't marry people of different anti-miscegenation law. Thank you. Okay. So, does the NAACP have to rent out its space to a church or an organization that has one of its tenets that that white people can't marry black people?
Madam Chair, religion is a protected class, and for over half a decade we've decided that public spaces cannot decline to serve people simply based on the customer's religion. And so your hypothetical is interesting. I think there might be a problem if the NAACP's decision not to rent a public space that it has otherwise been made available to all comers simply based on the religion of a specific applicant. I think the hypothetical is perhaps unlikely to occur, but if it does, the safer course of action for the NAACP would be to decide it is not going to rent the space to all comers instead of having it be a place of public accommodation. It is simply going to keep it private, in which case it would avoid the issue posed by your hypothetical.
Thank you. Does anybody have any more questions for either of the two folks who've been testifying? All right, then I am And is there anybody else either online or in this audience who wants to testify? No. Tara, you're looking at me. Did you want to testify? No. All right. Then I am going to close public testimony. Does anybody have any questions for Representative Tallarico's staffer, Mr. Banks? Okay, Representative Christ Tompkins.
Mr. Banks, do you know what municipality?
Do you want to let him identify himself and then?
Sure, absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Joshua Banks, staff to Representative Tallarico, and Representative apologize. He's in another committee, chairing that committee. So,
our neighbors down the hall, Mr. Banks, just for the sake of getting the scope and scale of the impact of this bill, it doesn't really change the status quo, as I understand it, based on previous testimony. In any part of Alaska where local government has not defined sexual orientation as a protected class, what areas of Alaska, what local governments have defined sexual orientation as a protected class, so we know where this bill would effectively have effect.
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, I'm not aware of all the communities that have labeled that as a protected class, but I just on that point, Madam Chair, I would like to reiterate what the sponsor stated yesterday, that this legislation is not targeted towards same-sex marriages. Although in many states, the Supreme Court's ruling on same-sex marriage was the start of laws very similar to this, or if not identical to this, our intention was not targeting same-sex marriages. It was also allowing, say, for an example, a pastor to not refuse a marriage of two Muslims or any whatever it just would allow a pastor to or any religious organization to organize to officiate weddings based on their religious views.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure sort of the solemnization of marriage is the crux here. I think everyone, including the ACLU, which just testified, agrees that that's sort of a kumbaya point. It seems as though sort of the crux of disagreement or differing perspectives is the services, accommodations, facilities, goods, etc., that could be related to the solemnization, formation, or celebration of marriage, i.e. a wedding reception. And I guess sort of two different questions maybe I should ask. If this isn't related to same-sex marriages, what problem are you trying to solve in addition to the sort of quandary that certain religious institutions may find themselves in as far as what class besides sexual orientation and same-sex marriages out there is creating a quandary for religious institutions? That's my first question. And my second question is there an institution in Anchorage, which we know has defined sexual orientation as a protected class, that, to your knowledge, has definitively changed its practices, i.e., instead of opening its facilities to the public, to all comers, has made itself private to, again, avoid this quandary in response to the Anchorage Assembly defining sexual orientation as a protected class? Again, two different questions.
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, I guess the answer to the first question is that to our knowledge in the state of Alaska, there are not any instances of a pastor being or any religious organization being essentially forced to officiate a wedding or have a reception at their church facility, but we had constituents that are pastors or clergy that were concerned that the Supreme Court ruling would potentially put them in a position where they would have to refuse to officiate the wedding or to allow for a reception to be held at their facility and possibly lead to civil litigation.
A clarifying question. So these are clergy, for instance, that presently do open their facilities up to all comers and make, say, a space available to rent to the public right now. And they live in Anchorage, presumably.
Through the chair, Representative Christ Thomas, I should have clarified the pastors or constituents, they live within District 6. They spoke to the representative directly, and so I'm not entirely aware of where they're located and if they do open their facilities to the public. So that would be a question I can follow up with you on.
Follow-up question, if I may, Madam Chair. Is there any community in District 6 that has defined sexual orientation as a protected class, therefore creating this problem for religious institutions?
Through Chair Representative Christ Tompkins, I do not believe so.
Is there anybody else who has questions for Mr. Banks?
One question, Mr. Banks. Did you have the letter from the ACLU has two proposed amendments. Did you have a chance to review those with Representative Tallarico before the hearing today?
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, this bill was pre-filed in January, and even though we did not take the opportunity to reach out to the ACLU regarding this, we, outside of a quote from Mr. Decker in the dispatch, we have not heard any comments or any contact from the ACLU regarding this bill, and so this is completely new to us.
My question is, did you have a chance to show him this letter before the hearing today?
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, no.
Okay.
Anybody else have any questions for Mr. Banks? Representative Mellott.
Well, on just responding to Jonathan Christ Tompkins, we were just having a talk, and he asked, would there be anybody else that would be getting married? And fundamentalist Mormons believe in polygamy, which would be something that we wouldn't wouldn't have to perform or wouldn't have to. I mean, that's an example of something outside of same-sex marriage that Jonathan was looking for an example. And fundamentalist Mormons that are polygamists, let's say, that would be an example of something that doesn't fit into the doctrine of the Catholic Church.
So. Thank you, Representative Mellott. Any other questions? Representative Lynn?
No.
Any committee comments?
I'd be curious to see what Representative Tallarico thinks of either of the two proposed amendments before we pass it in the committee.
I'm not going to hold up the bill for that. I've looked at them, and I know what I think of them. So, Representative Lynn, do you have any?
Well, yes, I think this is a good bill. I'm going to support it. I think it's a pro-ante bill, and quite frankly, chock full of common sense.
So, Representative Keller?
Madam Chair, with your permission, I move that we report HB 236 out of committee, LS 1290/alpha, out of Judiciary Committee with attached individual recommendations and zero fiscal note.
Hearing no objection, the bill is moved, and we will take a slight break to sign the paperwork. All right, next item is confirmation hearings. The following names have been submitted to House Judiciary Committee for consideration for the following boards and commissions: Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar, Adam Trombley; Commission on Judicial Conduct, Amy Gurton Mead, Robert Sheldon, Carla Taylor Welsh; Alaska Judicial Council, Loretta Bullard; Violent Crimes Compensation Board, Jared Godfrey, Committee on Legislative Ethics, H. Connor Thomas, Gary Turner. The committee members have previously received the resumes and applications for these appointments and have had the opportunity to review the qualifications of these applicants. The appointees were originally online for questions, but other than, did you say that it was Carla Taylor Welsh? I think she may be the only person still online. So, we've got Connor Thomas, who is still online, and Adam Trombley, who is online, Jared Godfrey, who is online, and Robert Sheldon, who is online, and also Carla Taylor Welsh, Amy Mead, and Loretta Bullard. So does anybody have any questions for any of these folks? All right. Well, if we don't have any questions.
We have one, just a short question for Mr. Trombley if he's online.
Mr. Trombley, are you online here?
Yes, I'm online.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm online.
Adam, as you know, this is Representative Klayman. I've served on the Board of Governors for 6 years, including a year as president of that board. And I always appreciated the input of the public members. How have you found being a public member on the Board of Governors? Because you're interested enough to keep doing it. So I just wanted to get a little brief bit from you in terms of how you have found service on the board as a public member.
Well, I'm far more confused about the definition of reasonable now than I was before I was on the board. attorneys like to debate, but I would say the things I've enjoyed the most about being on the board is the disciplinary component. I'm actually very impressed with how hard attorneys are on each other for those who break bar rules, and how stringent they hold them to it. And so that's been the best part. And I think speaking as just one of the public members, when we get there's discussions about, you know, changes to the bar rules, or, you know, how we're going to address something, or, you know, what we're going to pass on to the Supreme Court, because we do a lot of the legwork for the Supreme Court, I try to bring it back to how a common person, a non-attorney, would view what the board is doing. And so that's kind of how I view my role and the things that I've enjoyed about it. Does that answer your question, Representative Clemens?
I think largely. Just one other follow-up through the chair.
Go right ahead.
And as a public member, I know there's only three and you're outnumbered by the lawyers, but do you ever feel like your concerns as a public member are not weighed carefully by the entire board?
No, I've never felt that way. I've never felt that way. They're always very, the attorney members are always judicious about listening to our concerns.
You've learned something, too.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With regard to some of the other appointees here, I wanted to, first of all, thank Connor Thomas for putting his name back in. He's been on for a long time, and I think folks are familiar with him. So I wanted to move over to Loretta Bullard, who is new in coming on to or potentially coming on to the Judicial Council, and she's online, correct?
Yes, she is online.
Okay, I just wanted to, I've known Loretta for many years. Used to work for her. It was my first job coming out of college. And I just wanted to give her an opportunity. I'm very excited to hear that potentially we have somebody who can bring a rural perspective to this, and just wanted to give her the opportunity to maybe talk a little bit about some of the rural experience that she has.
Thank you, Neil. My name is Loretta Bullard, and I live here in Nome. I wasn't born here, but I was raised here. I recently retired about 4 years ago as president of CORE for 21 years, which is our regional nonprofit. And previous to that, I worked there for 7 years. And I had put my name in, I think it was last September, for consideration to the governor for appointment to the Judicial Council, and he did appoint me in October. And I was able to attend a meeting in October, and as well as just recently, I was able to participate in a meeting earlier this week, actually, at the Judicial Council. I wasn't able to travel to Anchorage because of the volcano, but I was able to participate video conferencing through the video conferencing equipment that they've got at the court system here, which is really wonderful, and I'm really pleased to see that in place. It's been very, very interesting participating in this process thus far. The first meeting we had reviewed a number of applicants for consideration for a Superior Court appointment in Anchorage, and then just earlier this week we considered the applicants for the Supreme Court, and I think it's a very good process, and I'm really pleased to be involved in it.
Madam Chair?
Go right ahead.
I want to say that Loretta has been very active with all kinds of different organizations, whether it's our regional Native nonprofit in Nome, AFN, other organizations, both Native and non-Native, throughout the state, and I've always known her to be a very fair person and a very smart person, so just wanted to say that. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions for any of the other applicants? Do any of the appointees wish to offer any testimony themselves? All right. Well, then I'm going to open public testimony. Do we have anybody online who wants to testify as to any of these applicants? Do we have anybody in the audience who wants to testify as to any of these applicants? Well, then I'm going to close public testimony. And if members do not have any further questions for these appointees, can we have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move the following people to the full body for consideration with the understanding that our vote here is not approval or disapproval. It's a vote to move the names forward to the full body. Adam Trombley to the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar, Amy Gerton-Mead to the and Robert Shelton and Carla Taylor Welsh to the Commission on Judicial Conduct, Loretta Bullard to the Alaska Judicial Council, Jared Godfrey to the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, and we've got H. Connor and Gary Turner to the Committee on Legislative Ethics.
And that's H. Connor Thomas.
H. Connor Thomas, thank you. That's the motion. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, without any objection, and in accordance with AS 2460-130, the Judiciary Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointees and recommends that the names be forwarded to the joint session for consideration for the following boards and commissions: Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar, Commission on Judicial Conduct, Alaska Judicial Council, Violent Crimes Compensation Board, Committee on Legislative Ethics. And moving these names forward does not reflect the intent of any member to vote either for or against this individual during any further sessions for the purposes of ratification of their appointment. And we'll have a brief at ease to sign the documents. Record. Next up, we have HJR 29 by Representative Keller. Representative Keller, would you like to tell us about your resolution, and do you want to go down there, or do you want to stay here?
Oh, Madam Chair, thank you for the option. With your permission, I'll stay here. This is Representative Keller.
That would be fine, Representative Keller.
District 10. The reason is that I have a pretty brief statement. I think it's a pretty easily understood bill. There's a lot to it. It's what it is a resolution that makes an appeal to Congress to call for a convention for an amendment to do term limits on the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives. And there's a lot of ways to go for introducing the bill. You know, I could spend time talking about federal overreach. I think you all have heard enough of that. You glaze over real quick. You know where I'm coming from. So what I want to do is just make a real brief comment about Article 5 itself in the Constitution, and then ask, we have Nick here, this will make more sense why we have testimony on it after I to say a few comments about Article 5. Article 5 is part of the original U.S. Constitution. To me, it's a huge statement. If you stop and think about it, the founders who worked on this so hard, one of the things they worked on is they realized there might have to be changes down the road. And so they included Article 5 in the U.S. Constitution that provided for two ways for making an amendment to change the Constitution, foreseeing the time when there may need to be some adjustments. There's been 33 that the U.S. Congress, one of the methods is that the U.S. Congress, both houses have to have two-thirds vote. I think there's been 33 of those put forward. The other one is the Article 5 process that you're hearing a lot about, like Convention of the States and whatever. And that is what this particular one is. It is when two-thirds of the states make application to the Congress to get this done. And then the Congress calls the convention, and then it takes three-fourths of the states to ratify. And I think that we forget what a high bar that is. There has been only 27 of the 33 that Congress offered got ratified by three-fourths of the state. So it's a very high bar. There's a growing interest. Just for interest's sake, I have the expert come up. And the reason I call him the expert is obviously to get two-thirds of the state to come together and put forward language to Congress that there isn't a dispute on, like this one's different than that one. There needs to be coordination. And I was very fortunate to find Nick and his organization, U.S. Term Limits, that are coordinating this. And so I'll have him come up and let him make, if you would, Madam Chair, let him make a presentation, and then he is available for questions.
Thank you. So if you could please identify yourself for the record, and then you may proceed.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Keller.
His first name is Nick. His last name starts with Tom. And the reason I didn't give you his last name is because
don't even try.
I get my tongue tangled.
I'm going to guess it's Tombalides. Is that close?
That is exactly right, Madam Chair, and I think you're the first person to ever get it right on the first shot. Yes, for the record, Madam Chair, my name is Nick Tombalides. I am the Executive Director of U.S. Term Limits. We are the nation's only organization that's full-time dedicated to placing term limits on the United States Congress, and I really thank you for having me here to testify. I'll give you some background. In the 1990s, our organization helped citizens in 23 states put term limits on their members of Congress using ballot measures, including right here in Alaska. And it passed in 23 states. At that point, it was just shy of 50% of the entire Congress that would have had a term limit, and it looked like it was going to be inevitable that that would impel the Congress itself to propose an amendment that would apply to everyone. But that was not to be, because the Supreme Court stepped in the decision U.S. Term Limits v. Thornton, of which our organization was a part, and ruled that the list of qualifications for office to the Congress in the Constitution is exhaustive, that the states cannot utilize the ballot measure, state statutes, or state constitutional amendments to add on to it. So while they foreclosed on that possibility, I guess you could say the silver lining was that they opened up the possibility to get this done using a constitutional amendment. And so the U.S. Constitution says, as Representative Keller mentioned, that upon application from two-thirds of the states, so that would be 34 at this point, Congress shall call a convention for the purpose of proposing amendments. And so the convention that Alaska would call for in this resolution is exclusive to the subject of congressional term limits, and it would not go active until
33 other states have passed similar or the same resolution. So far, my home state of Florida was the first to pass the resolution back in February. Now, we think that HJR 29 should be adopted because there is a very real concern that members of Congress are removed from their constituents, and they rely too heavily on incumbency to deflect challenges at the ballot box. In the latest average from Real Clear Politics, Congress had a 13% approval rating, but a 95% re-election rating for the incumbents. And I think that evidence suggests that you have a broken system. There was also a study done by Princeton and Northwestern universities in 2014 where they analyzed over 2,000 public opinion surveys on almost all national issues, and they compared those public opinions to the policies that became law from Congress. And the researchers concluded that the preferences of the average American have a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact upon congressional policy. But when they looked at, you know, the perceptions and views of the upper 10% of earners in the country, the ones that were funding the PACs and the reelections of the congressmen, there was a correlation. So I think most people feel disconnected from Congress in this way. They feel that their voices are not being heard at the federal level, and that's part of what term limits are intended to address. Congress was not intended to be a Congress was intended to be a citizen legislature whose members were very close to their constituents and would come home to spend time around them, much in the way that you all do it here in Alaska. But the mentality was lost as the population grew, the size and the complexity of government grew, and so did the needs that it had to address. You know, Alaska's noted for having a small state legislature, but in terms of the actual representation ratio and the size of the districts, you know, how powerful each individual voter and constituent of yours is, you're one of the best in the country. And when you compare that to Congress with an average House district size of 700,000 people, you're looking at great difficulty in holding members of Congress accountable. And that's when special interests and tend to step into the vacuum and really decide who can get elected, because the cost of unseating a U.S. House incumbent is pegged at $2.5 million by the Foundation for Government Accountability. And so we view that as sort of a barrier to entry for the average person, you know, the farmer, the school teacher, the union member who wants to get elected and have their voice heard in Washington. So term limits would reduce those barriers to entry, and it's important to note the amendment is not aimed at any one member of Congress, nor is it guaranteed to affect the current membership. In fact, at a convention, the delegates that you all select and that the other states select would be in charge of deciding how long and what the appropriate term limit is, whether the current members are grandfathered in, whether it's prospective or retroactive. That's not something that comes mandated from this resolution. And the most important thing, I think, is that this would really honor the views of a vast majority of Alaskans. There was, in 1994, the vote from the people of Alaska for congressional term limits was 63% in favor of a statute limiting congressional terms, and that's actually still on the books today in Title 15, Chapter 30 of Alaska statutes. Of course, this is nullified by the Supreme Court in the Thornton case, but that's what left the door open to do it with constitutional amendments. And then recent polling done by McLaughlin and Associates, which is a respected polling firm, found that 78% of Alaskans today now support an Article 5 amendment convention to put term limits on Congress. And you can slice that every age, race, gender, party, demographic group, and they're all equally supportive of it. So, you know, in closing, as the vice chair said, the history of Article 5 really makes it the perfect tool for the states to use at a time like this. It was written into the Constitution specifically so that the states could bypass Congress and obtain amendments that might not be in Congress' best interest. And, you know, there's never been a better moment for the states to take action and kind of reestablish this balance with Congress, give Congress back to the American people who are obviously disillusioned by the performance. So thank you for your time, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you have.
Representative Keller.
As one who really values the U.S. Constitution and
the values around it. A question that comes to my mind is that is why there were no term limits included in the original Constitution. provision for amendment is there, but there were no term limits.
Through the chair, Rep. Keller, the founding fathers were sort of divided on the issue of term limits, and obviously they had a lot, you know, greater concerns of preserving the union at that point and making sure that there was a new constitution that could endure. But the issue did come up, and several of the founders were in favor of a term limit. It was actually Benjamin Franklin who wrote a term limit into the Constitution of Pennsylvania. Thomas Jefferson, upon getting, he was actually not at the Philadelphia Convention, but upon seeing it for the first time after coming back from France, he noted that the absence of rotation in office, which was a term limit, would end in abuse for the Senate and for the President. So I think one big reason why it wasn't included is that they didn't think it would be necessary. You know, the average tenure in Congress did not rise above two terms until the beginning of the 20th century, so you had very rapid turnover, and Washington, D.C. was not so much a place of profit and power as it is today, and so people actually wanted to leave Washington rather than go there and stick. It was the opposite of what you have today, different dynamic.
Sort of the feeling in general.
Yeah, somewhat. You tell me. I don't know.
Do we have any more questions, or do we have any questions for Mr. Tombalidis?
Oh, dear.
Representative Chris Tompkins.
Thank you. A few questions. So I was reading through some of the backup materials. It's accurate that each state would basically determine its own election process for delegates who would go to the Constitutional Convention. Am I getting that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, that is correct, yes.
Follow-up question, Madam Chair. How active is sort of an application, if you will, for a constitutional convention? How much time is the window open to get to that two-thirds of states threshold?
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, if there is no termination date within the applying resolution, then it is just active indefinitely. But it's recommended that if an application goes too long without being renewed, that you should go ahead and renew it and do it again, mostly because of the way the language has to conform with resolutions coming from other states across the country. So if Alaska were to pass this out now, and then in 15 years, Alabama goes to do the same thing, the language and the procedures may not be the same. And that could present a problem for this effort, because at the end, while Congress has very limited authority in this process, they do decide whether the applications are on the same subject and can choose to decline a convention on that basis.
Follow up. Is it a possible scenario that if every resolution from every state calling for an Article 5 constitutional convention is not verbatim identical, that Congress, again, theoretically, could strike down or decline to call the convention on the base of those sort of technical and trivial differentiations?
Through the chair, Representative, I think that is theoretically possible. Some of the case law suggests that the courts would be empowered to step in and resolve Article 5 disputes like that, so the court could step in and compel Congress to call the convention if it deems the applications on the same subject. I would say on this matter that it is critically important for the states not to give Congress excuses to deny the convention. So the greater variation you have in the resolutions, the more likely it is that Congress will simply ignore them. And in fact, there have been 400-plus applications sent by the states to Congress for an Article 5 convention, but it's still never been done because they're not on the same topic. So it is critically important to have them very similar in language, and that's part of what U.S. term limits does, going around the country to work with legislators for that level of conformity.
Follow-up question. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess on that last point that you just touched on, how many states thus far, and you mentioned Florida, but how many states thus far have have called for a convention on this subject, and then what is the closest the United States has come to an Article 5 convention on another subject? What's the highest number of states that we've ever gotten to on a different subject?
On your first, through the chair, on your first question, Representative, Florida is actually the only state that has passed the applying resolution for this particular convention thus far. But then again, you know, we as an activist group have only recently begun canvassing the country and trying to generate support for this from the grassroots. And so what you're seeing right now in the current year session is upwards of 10 states that are considering similar resolutions right now. And to address your second question, it was actually the amendment for direct election of senators in 1913 that got closest to getting an Article 5 convention. They were one state short of the two-thirds, and what happened was Congress preempted the states, and the Senate finally caved in after years of trying and proposed that amendment on their own. So part of the way Article 5 has worked historically is not just to endeavor to get to a convention, but also to put pressure on Congress to propose amendments that they wouldn't otherwise propose. And in fact, that's how the Bill of Rights was actually proposed, with the threat of a second convention. James Madison promised a Bill of Rights, and then that threat went away.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm really curious about this process. I think it's fascinating, and I'm actually I think there's a lot of merit to this, and the federal system is pretty broken. And I was sort of running this idea by a lot of people that you know, whose knowledge of our political system I enjoy engaging with, and I'm always a little bit cautious when we're talking about the U.S. Constitution, and now we as state legislatures through this process in a roundabout way have our hands on the levers, and that kind of frightens me a little bit. But in this instance, pleased to see this coming through, interested to see where it goes, and thank you for the responses.
Representative Keller, and then Representative Klingman, because I can tell you're thinking of something.
This is a comment, but I want to make it because I would like Nick to challenge it or maybe add to it. But the Convention of States has a constitutional attorney that I have come to appreciate and respect, and he's thrown light on a couple of things. His name is Ralph Nadelson, and there's a legislative compendium that really is fascinating. And you expressed your interest, and if you want, I'll get you a copy of it. But one of the things that I learned that I didn't know in reading that compendium is how much conventions have been part of the history of the United States of America. So it was so common. There was just a time here, and it seems like in the last 40, 50, 60, 100 years maybe, that they've been diminished, you know. So it sounds strange to us at first, but the more you look into it, you realize there is good case law. There's a really good history. There's good policy. I mean, it's very viable.
Representative Klingman.
So I take it in the interesting discussion that's been picked up again with the recent death of Justice Scalia, the fact that the framers originally rejected the idea of term limits as part of their original intent, this allows one to change the intent of the Constitution by amending it.
Through the chair, are you asking me to affirm that statement?
Yes.
The framers knew, Representative Klingman, that they were really crafting a document that they intended to endure for a very long time. It was not for one particular period in history, but hopefully to last, as long as this republic could. And they knew that a constitution like ours needed an accessible means of amendment. So if you go back and read the writing of the framers, they were very open about the fact that some of their work might need correcting, and you know, they didn't have any shame over that fact.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Tambalidis? So I'm going to just kind of respond to your question, Representative Klayman. Are you suggesting that because the founders allowed for a mechanism for change of the Constitution, that that's somehow at odds with the Scalia reading, the strict constructionist? Because I think the strict constructionist would say that the Constitution isn't supposed to be changed through judicial interpretation, but there's a difference between judicial interpretation and actually an amendment to change something.
Oh, I completely agree. I actually, as you probably know, when I even reading Justice Scalia's opinion, the places in which he thinks that original intent has some place has a remarkable convenience with his general jurisprudential philosophy, and when it wasn't convenient, it didn't seem to be part of his analysis. And so it was more of an observation that to the extent one looks at the Constitution and it didn't have term limits, one could easily say, well, the original intent was to not have term limits, but because there's an amendment process.
Well, of course that was the original intent, not to have term limits, but the Constitution also allowed for changes through the amendment process.
I agree completely.
Can I add something, Chair?
Go ahead, Representative Keller.
If I understand it right, my memory's a little rusty. I haven't reviewed this in a while, but I think the part about the states making the call to Congress was added after they changed the Article 5 to include that, and it was on the insistence of, and the name isn't coming to me, but one of them we would know if I could name him. Yeah, please, Nick, go ahead. Bail me out here.
Through the Chair, Representative Keller, it was George Mason.
Thank you.
Who insisted on this approach because he believed that no amendment, he said no amendments of the proper kind would ever be obtained, if only Congress had the sole authority of proposing.
Thank you. Representative Christ Tompkins?
Just a comment. I mean, it kind of strikes me analogous to the Alaska Constitution, that sort of safety valve where you have entrenched self-interest. I was reading through the history of the referendum process provided in the Alaska Constitution last night, and of course there have only been four instances of referenda, of which only two have been successful. But the one that was wildly successful in 1980 was when the legislature decided to create its own Cadillac retirement system for legislators. And surprise, the people of Alaska weren't very excited about that idea. So it got repealed by a 4-1 margin. And I'm just sort of analogizing that in this case where you've got people in Congress and D.C. who have entrenched self-interest, which is to keep their seats and be protected by the overwhelming and prolific power of incumbency, and just with the direct election of senators, and that history must be fascinating from 100 years ago. This seems like another example.
Any further questions for Mr. Tomalides? Well, I actually have one then. So, it seems like this makes a lot of sense on a national level. But I wonder how it would affect a small state such as Alaska, where the power that we might have is going to come from seniority. And if you can only have a couple of terms, there's not going to be much seniority. So does Alaska end up on the losing end of this deal? Why or why not?
Madam Chair, I don't believe that Alaska winds up on the losing end of the deal because the seniority question actually seems to cut both ways. When you're in the position in which you have a very long-term member of the Congress, in the current system, which is seniority driven, that is very advantageous. But at the moment that that member decides to retire, decides to step down.
They never decide to step down.
Well, you know, I mean, all of our careers are finite in one way or another, but at that moment, though, you're immediately at a counteracting disadvantage in that you have to jump right back to the front of the line. And so I think it really does cut both ways. It depends at which point you're on, but it's not always a positive thing for a small state like that. I think it would also be good for Alaska if Congress were made less about seniority and more about the merits of the issues, because I think some of the arguments that Alaska has with regard to the federal government are very sound, and you should not need seniority to be able to push back against the federal government. That should just be common sense for the majority of Congress.
But if you ended up abolishing the seniority system, wouldn't there be a tendency for a small state like Alaska to get lost if everybody from New York or everybody from California, you know, voted their regional ways, and there'd be no way to counterbalance that?
Madam Chair, I don't think there's much of a dispute over the fact that most members of Congress under the status quo are voting primarily for their region, and they are also primarily voting for power to be more concentrated in Washington, D.C. I think under a term-limited system where you have a larger portion of the citizenry getting sent to Washington, there would be a lot more, I think, skepticism of Washington being the solution to every problem. So I don't know if it would create a regional bent, but it would certainly create a bent in favor of the citizens' wishes rather than those of, you know, the Washington political class.
Okay, but you're absolutely right. People are voting on a regional
basis.
But if you have a seniority system in which a member from a small state can rise up there in seniority and chair a powerful committee based upon seniority, then that can be used sometimes to counterbalance the regionalism. Mr. Tombalides answer the question, and then you can respond to it, Representative Christ Tompkins.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, what was the question now?
Just say yes, I agree with that.
Yes. I concur.
I was suggesting that even though people tend to vote on a regional basis, that can be countered by a member from a small state rising through the seniority system so that they are in a powerful position to counter the regional votes.
Okay, Madam Chair, I think that is accurate to an extent in the current system, but do you really want them being on an island of that view? Even if they have a powerful spot on a committee, is it necessarily a good thing that the rest of Congress is not so sympathetic to the interest of an individual state, because the rest of Congress has become so rooted in Washington that every solution needs to be solved in Washington? So I think if you had term limits, the members from other states, even though they would subscribe to more a regionalist view, which you can't ever get rid of, I think they would be more sympathetic to Alaska's position, as a sovereign with regard to the federal government. So I think they would be more respecting and more deferring to Alaska's rights to control its own land and kind of push back against what Washington is doing.
I guess I wonder what evidence you have of that. Why, without the power of somebody from a small state to hold a bill or to otherwise make perhaps members who are antithetical to the interests of their state, why do you think that without that strength or that power, that just because that they just decide to be nice?
Madam Chair, I believe that because I believe that if you if you do implement term limits on Congress, which would automatically make elections more competitive, would automatically level the playing field for these districts, you would have Congress that is more responsive to the needs of not just the people of Alaska, but the entire country. And, you know, in my opinion at least, I think that the people of the country are a lot smarter than the permanent political class in Washington. And so, you know, as we looked at the Princeton-Northwestern thing that said the bottom 90% of people in the country don't have their public policy opinions reflected in Congress at all, I think that that's greatly damaging to our republic. And I think that the ideas that the public would generate if they were able to have better access to Congress would be good ideas.
Thank you. I see you want to answer the question, Representative Christ Tompkins.
I have a few thoughts, Madam Chair. I mean, first of all, to your I guess query for Representative Klayman's word of choice is rubbing off on me being on this committee as to whether small states may be disenfranchised through term limits. To me, there's two responses, and the first is the U.S. Senate. And small states are already enfranchised with disproportionate power through the U.S. Senate. And regardless of whether there's far higher turnover in the U.S. Senate, simply by dint of having the same number of representatives in that body as a state like California or Texas, we're I think, already enfranchised by the Constitution. But the second is we would only be disenfranchised, and we're talking about a proportionality of power in Congress, in the House of Representatives, if there's a correlation between greater seniority and a small state. And while that's true in Alaska right now, because we have Don Young, who's been in there since dinosaurs roamed the earth, with all due respect to Don Young.
And dinosaurs.
dinosaurs. I think we just created a new kind of dinosaur. A dinosaur. Again, with respect. States like Montana or Hawaii or Maine have had a lot of turnover in Congress, and so you have a small state that's actually had disproportionately less power because they have very high turnover within their congressional delegation. So I guess just sort of a point that we might be a little bit blinded in Alaska because not all states have had Congressman Young who's served forever, and on the bigger perspective, I'm not sure this would actually have a prejudicial effect on the amount of power that small states have in Congress.
I guess my response to that is it might not have power, have an awful lot of impact on other small states, but it might have on our small state. Representative Klayman.
This is more discussion amongst the committee, and we get to have our witness.
Yeah, we probably should get back to. Are there any more questions?
I have a motion. No, I'm kidding.
Are there any more questions? I'm going to call you Nick because even though I got it right at first, I seem to be butchering it as the time goes on.
I would just note in the context of all this that the notion about term limits, whatever they are. In theory, if you had term limits, it would benefit the states that were electing the more qualified and skilled and capable people to start serving in the House and the Senate. And if the states made a wise choice of those they have picked, then those states with term limits would actually do better than those that gain from seniority, whereas the states that may not have made such a good choice. And I'm struck that without naming names, I've read that one of the people that has been involved in the current presidential campaigns is thought to be one of the most disliked and inability to work within the House of the U.S. Congress that he serves in. And it strikes me, well, yes, if you've got somebody you could really be very sorry about, you could be pleased with term limits because the ineffectiveness would soon go away. But if you had somebody that was remarkably affected, you would be very sorry to see them go. Mm-hmm. And I think in Alaska, which is why I think we struggle with this so much in Alaska, is not so much Representative Young, but Senator Stevens, I think, was effective very early in his career and stayed that way for many years. And so not only would he have been a good senator in his early days with term limits, but the fact that there weren't term limits, his power got to be more so. So It's an interesting question that you raise. I guess it doesn't really bear call for a response. It's just this is the discussion that we have in Alaska, I would say, every day.
Thank you, Representative Klayman. Do we have any more questions for Nick? All right. Thank you very much.
And
you came all the way from Florida to be here?
That is correct.
Well, thank you.
Where in Florida?
Through the chair, Melbourne, Florida.
So the next we go to public testimony, and I do not believe that we've got anybody online. Is that correct? Do we have anybody in the audience? Well, then, seeing nobody in the audience, I am going to close public testimony. Wonder if anybody on the committee has any more questions or comments. My intention is not to move the bill today, but anybody have any comments on it? All right. Well, our next hearing is going to be Monday, April 4th, where we're going to be bringing up House Bill 194, hearing amendments on HB 205, and maybe there'll be some other bills that we've already heard that we will also be taking up. This has been, I have not had a session on constitutional law like this since I finished constitutional law in law school when the dinosaurs were roaming the earth. And it is 4 o'clock, and we stand adjourned.